This title is a little bit different from what you have in your program. And the reason is that I compared my description with the description I had in 2014. And as you can see, if you calculate a difference map, this is it. So I figured it's the same topic. So the slides are a little bit different, though. So heterogeneity, you already heard about from Shores, and he's really working on great methods to sort out these big machines. I'm going to talk about some of the challenges, not necessarily the solutions. And as you'll see, I'm going to go a little crazy with the case I'm going to consider, just to highlight what the real challenges might be, you know, when you go to extreme heterogeneity. So heterogeneity can have many sources. Of course, you could have damage to your protein, impurities, whatever. But I guess the opportunity and the thing that makes this really interesting is that biological molecules have a natural tendency to move as they do their work. And so looking at this heterogeneity and sorting out the different states also will tell us about the mechanism of these molecules. And so this is, I guess, the main reason why we would like to get better at telling apart these different states and so on. Okay, so these are just a few examples, recent examples or not so recent examples, where heterogeneity is well established and where you can learn a lot about following the different states. So you can distinguish different types of heterogeneity, but probably more than I'm going to have here on this slide. But one of the common ones is compositional heterogeneity, where you may have a ligand that is sometimes not bound and sometimes bound. Then you can have conformational heterogeneity, discrete here in this case, where a molecule changes its shape. You can also have continuous heterogeneity, maybe an arm of Jan or so. Then you can have, of course, everything together occurring at the same time. Okay, and so maybe you can distinguish other heterogeneity, but this is the sort of thing that you'll likely find in a population of molecules that you're looking at. Now, the goal of processing, image processing, when it comes to heterogeneity is usually that when we look at a mixture of different molecules that may have different, you know, compositional, conformational states, to sort them into separate groups. And these molecules can then be averaged to arrive at higher resolution. Okay, so that's the general goal of classification that's implemented in different software packages. So I'm not going to go more into the detail of algorithms, but I thought I should focus my talk on challenges. And if you want to interrupt me on a particular challenge, then please do so. So I thought of a hypothetical experiment that may highlight this problem. And so you've already seen the slide. If we start with a bunch of cells and put them into a grinder, then put the crude extract on a grid, we can image everything. And wouldn't it be nice if, by taking thousands of pictures, we end up with reconstructions of all of the different molecules and all of the different states? Okay, I mean, this is, of course, something that is currently not possible. But the question is, why is it not possible? Now, you can think about the size of the data set that you need. And so here is some consideration. If we think, and this is probably an estimate that's too low, if we think that we have something like 1,000 different species to worry about that are larger than 100 kilodaltons in this extract, and in addition, we recognize that not all species are at the same concentration. There will be some molecular species that will not be populated very highly, and then others that occur much more often. So there's a, I just assumed there's sort of a histogram with, you know, on the one side, one species that is just 1% concentrated compared to the one that is most concentrated, 100%. So something like this. So if, and you also demand that you want to have at least 30,000 particles in each class at the end, so that you can calculate a high resolution structure, then you can calculate with these different assumptions how many particles the data set must have. Any idea? Back of the envelope calculation. Right, so it's 1.5 billion particles. And of course, this clearly is a very big data set. You know, I guess right now we're talking about 2 or 3 million at the most of what people have collected for something like this. And in general, for a very heterogeneous mix, you need to collect a lot of data in order to have enough particles for all the states that you want to discover. Okay, so that, I guess, is the message here. So for very heterogeneous data sets, you need a lot of data. Now, let's see how long that would take to process. Since there is a hot topic on, you know, processing, making that more faster and so on. So we assume 1.5 billion particles. And we also, and that is completely, you know, unproven and so on, we assume that the classification behaves in some way like a sorting algorithm. And so the fast sorting is an n log n algorithm. So if, so n is the number of elements that you want to sort, and so it goes up, you know, the time you to sort n elements behaves like n log n. Okay, and so we also have from publications of the beta galactosidase data set processed by different packages, for example, Reliant 2, that 2D classification of 130,000 particles takes about 8 hours, and 3D classification, 7 hours. So that's the slide that Shores showed just briefly in his talk. Now, you can calculate based on this and this and this that 2D classification takes 19 years and 3D classification takes 17 years. And again, you know, probably the dependence of classification is not n log n for these types of classification algorithms, but probably more like n squared. So it's just to highlight that this could become a real problem as we move to more complex things, right? I mean, not just a small problem, but a big problem. So we really have to think about, I want to point out, of course, these are times obtained by processing on a single workstation using 4 GPUs, right? Something like that. So I'm going to come back to this a bit later. Now, another challenge that you will encounter when you look at such a heterogeneous mix is the small classes. So most people know when they try to discover classes in their data set that are not well populated, that there's usually a problem with this. Because as people have seen in the past, and then also, you know, written algorithms like ISAC to counter, large classes tend to attract the particles from smaller classes, just because when you calculate these comparisons between classes and particles, you know, the particle is assigned according to how good the correlation coefficient is ultimately. And so a good class, even if it is, if it has a difference with respect to the particle, may still produce a higher correlation coefficient than a weak class where the reference is quite noisy. Okay, and so then you have particles being misassigned to different classes. And so that is particularly troublesome for particles that do not occur very frequently in your data set. So there will be a detectability problem that will depend on the, obviously, on the size and shape of the molecule. And also, I guess related to this, there are many people who I talked to who mentioned that when you follow the workflow where you first have a 2D classification And then you clean up your data set, and then later a 3D classification. You often discard particles in the 2D classification step that could have been assigned in the 3D refinement and classification. Perhaps, for example, because they represent rarer views, and therefore, due to this mechanism of stronger classes sort of attracting things and so on, you have misassignments. And anyway, the 2D classification is, or every classification step is a possible step where you throw away something that you might be able to assign at a later stage. Okay, so then there's another problem with convergence of these algorithms. And Shor's already mentioned this briefly with local optima. And maximum likelihood is a nice, very nice algorithm. Works much better than sort of hard assignments of particles to different classes, but it is not an absolute protection against ending up in a local optimum. And so this is just, again, I realize I show Axel Below's work here several times. This is sort of an earlier result before we then got the final classes, where we had a mixed class here that did not separate this EFG factor that was bound here. And so if you didn't know that this was a mixture, I mean, for the ribosome, we understand very well what the different structures are. But if you didn't know this, and this was a completely new structure, you might be tempted to go ahead and interpret this in some way and publish this. Okay, so it can easily happen, of course, with very heterogeneous data sets, more easily than with something that only has a few classes, that you end up with final classes that are still mixtures of states. So that's actually a significant danger. And as far as I can tell, the only protection against this is to repeat this classification, maybe in different ways, and see if you can reproduce the classes. You can detect heterogeneity that may still be present in a class using things like variance maps. So this is from a work from Joachim Frank, where they discovered that this part here is quite mobile. But of course, this is quite computationally expensive. It's very sensitive to particle misalignments. And also, usually, these variance maps are quite noisy and only have sort of low resolution information. So in order to sort out finer detail, they may not work so well. All right. Another challenge is reproducibility. So this is a slide I showed also before. So this is reprocessing Yifan's very nice trip channel data set using Freeline. And so this slide here shows the map as published using Reliant, and this is the map as published, not published, I guess also published in a review now, using Freeline. And so the number of particles are quite similar in both of these structures, but the overlap, between these two is only 23,000, so about 60%, which is kind of surprising because it sort of suggests that there are good particles that ended up in Reliant that Freeline did not pick, and vice versa. And so, it's another indication that this classification is not necessarily reproducible or even quantitative. So,
if you would run Reliant twice, you might even have the same thing, because these classes making this, again, this discrete, this fantastic.
My assumption was that this would be the case, but it may also be just very sensitive to little details of how you implemented this, right? It's sort of inherently.
Just to follow up on George's comment, I ask the question, does it have to be that way?
I don't know.
Perhaps not. Perhaps you can, again, do things like marginalization might be a bit difficult in this context, but you could run it multiple times and do a bit like ISAC and see which ones are always there and which ones aren't, and then weigh particles up or down according
to. Part
of
the problem is also overfitting, even though we don't like to talk about it, but you know, depending on, we don't see this here in this map, but there's also some background noise in there that is probably different. So the signal agrees between the two, but the noise probably doesn't. And so you will end up selecting some particles that fit better one noise compared to other noise or whatever. So, yeah. I did. That's a slide that I didn't put in here. Of course, it is worse because it has fewer particles. But for example, I calculated a map using the Freeland parameters that I obtained for these particles, but that did not end up all in this class, just to see. And that was also a good map.
Yeah, I have a question for this number, CT percent. I have several different proteins, the size from 200 kD to 400 kD. If I run rely on several times, repeat just the same thing, I always get something around 60%. Is this related to protein size or?
Yeah, I know it should be 42, right? But I don't know. It's probably nothing special about 60%. Maybe it has to do with, as you say, with the molecular weight and the amount of noise that you have in there. You know, I mean, at some point when you have large changes that you're trying to classify, I'm sure you can reproducibly get the same selection. It must have something to do with how noisy the data is.
Nico, so in the because of this attract effect that you were mentioning in the maximum likelihood algorithms, then is it better then when you start your classification to ask for a large number of classes or start with a very small number, because then that way all of them are, you know, have similar signal to noise ratio, you don't suffer that much of that effect. So what's, I guess, this?
Right. I guess the idea of stochastic methods is you add noise. It's apparently become a good thing to do. So in this would be similar to diluting your strong classes to become a little noisier. Now you have several of them, but they're all a little noisier. And yes, that might be one way of dealing with this. Of course, it's not a nice way of dealing with this. I think in the end, it would be nicer to have a way that doesn't involve adding noise.
Question here. So I guess the whole stochastic method has to do with that you would not assign a particle to a particular orientation and to allow it to the population to decide what it is. So would this suggest that we actually should also weigh the particle differently because their noise, I guess, no, in a sense that the particles has different qualities. Some of them are has better quality than the others.
The particles are weighted here. And I guess the assignment of a particle to a class is to some degree arbitrary because there are just probabilities. And I guess these are the particles that have the largest probability or highest probability for this class, but this probably wasn't 100%.
A lot of times that when it says a particle is in a class, that doesn't actually mean that it's being assigned 100% in there. It's still present in other classes. Is that how it works?
That's correct, yes. But I mean, it's, yes. Rod?
Maybe you said it and I missed it. Did you take one program and repeat in C with the same program, just but different starting points, what overlap you get? So this comparing two, but what
right.
happens if you, so is
running
it the program
times.
Or the data?
So I have not done this, but Shores just said that when he runs Relion, multiple times on a data set, he cannot 100% reproduce his classification.
But I've done this, Rich Height and I did this with Relion in this classification scheme, sort of looking at two different states of a protein and running Relion classification something like five times.
Mm-hmm.
And then could discover that for a given conformation, we got something like 80% of the particles four or five times, and it equals at least four, ended up in the same classification. So it seemed quite
reliable. But it must, as I said, it must depend on the size of the thing that you're trying to pick up. And I mean, in this case, the rest of the particles that are not shown here or not included here were junk. So it is not clear why they were junk. All I can say is, based on this, obviously some particles were not junk, they were just put there. I mean, this could be studied more, but the purpose of running Freeline was just to see if Freeline can process this data set. It wasn't, you can do more systematic investigation of this, of course. Anyway, so the challenge here overall is, given all these problems, that the structural interpretation of any differences and or the different classes might be difficult. Continuous states are a challenge, and one approach at the moment to deal with molecules that can have any range of conformations, any conformation continuously, is to just artificially divide up the different continuum into discrete states. But you can also try to model it somehow. So this is this was a long time ago that we looked at this, 2010 maybe, at clathrin cages. So they have a tendency to be a little bit squishy. And so I was trying to model that squishiness with a distortion matrix and a distortion parameter that I could build into Freeline to basically match for each particle a certain amount of distortion. So, in the refinement, in the particle refinement that I carried out here, I was then getting the alignment parameters, XY positions, and on top of it, an additional parameter that would tell me about this particular distortion of the particle. And when you can, if this sort of thing, so I would say, at the time, this didn't make much of a difference, sort of improved things a little bit. Here, the Fourchard correlation at 22 angstroms. Anyway, so probably not that significant, but it's just to highlight the idea that one way to deal with continuous heterogeneity is to somehow model these states. And of course, one piece of work here from Slavika Jonik's lab uses normal modes, and I think somebody mentioned this earlier during Schroes's talk, as a way of assigning parameters to these different states. So normal modes, I think some people also interpret them as telling you about the biology and mechanism of machines like this, and that's probably more questionable. So I'm not meaning to say that you can learn something about the mechanism of the molecule here, but you can this way introduce parameters that can then be refined in the same way I just described with these clathrin cages to determine different conformational states of your molecule in each image. You can also work with masks. So that's some earlier work, again, with Schroes, where he uses a mask to align just part of the ribosome to get a better reconstruction. And so he talked a lot more about this, so I don't need to. There are different other ways of masking. So this is a type of masking that we often use with Freeline that is particularly useful when you have membrane proteins that have a well-ordered part, the protein, and a not so well-ordered part, the micelle, detergent micelle, or amphipole micelle. And so this mask here, so this is the mask that Alexei used, so this is a collaboration with John Rubinstein, would only mask out the protein. But the way Freeline uses this is that it applies the mask to the protein, but then it keeps a low-pass filtered version of whatever is outside the mask in the reference. So the combination of the masked bit and the low-pass filtered bit looks like this. And so that is useful in cases like membrane proteins, because the micelle itself produces a pretty strong signal in the images, and at low resolution is still a very useful signal that helps in the alignment of the particles. Okay, so this is sort of a hybrid masking that works with a low-pass filter. This is recent work from Rod McKinnon's lab, Rich Height, looking at the slow 2 channel and titrating sodium ion concentration to see how the open state population changes as a function of the salt concentration. And I picked this up because this is, of course, a wonderful example of how to deal with heterogeneity and learn about the dynamical behavior of the molecule. And I was hoping to make a statement about this data set, but of course, Rod already knew what to do, which is when you try to study multiple states like this and connect biochemistry with structure, so here the salt concentration with the different population of different structures, you have to be quite careful because, as I had already mentioned with the trip channel, typically when you work with a preparation, you end up with a lot of particles that for one reason or another give significantly lower resolution reconstructions. We usually call these junk classes. And so this is just an example of this VSD polymerase, a collaboration with Steve Harrison and Sean Whelan at Harvard Medical School. And so, you know, the final reconstruction has far fewer particles than the original data set. And so the question is, what makes these particles that went into the junk classes junk? But, so I can't answer this, but there's a worry when you look at multiple states of a molecule, like Rod had done, and you have a junk class, which Rod turns out did not have for that reason. He didn't allow junk. You know, the junk may be recruited at different rates from different classes, and so therefore your final picture of percentages may be misleading. Okay, so this is another challenge, I guess, in general, of looking at heterogeneity and making quantitative statements about the different populations. Preferred views are a big challenge to studying heterogeneity, and so this is from Dimitri's work on flu hemagglutinin, and of course the solution here is to tilt. I just wanted to mention it as another challenge when you have a very heterogeneous data set. Of course, with preferred views, it's going to be much harder to tell apart different states. It's also, so this is again from Rod's lab, another challenge is how very small changes and how to detect them. So here for the CLC chloride channel or transporter, there's a gate that depends just on a single side chain here. That flips in and out. And so if you had a population of these transporters and wanted to separate them into open and close, that would probably be very difficult. I would say probably impossible with our current technology. So there will be small changes that may be interesting and biochemically important or mechanistically important that we will not be able to separate. Now, another challenge that people who work with heterogeneous data sets often face is to decide on the number of different classes to that are appropriate to describe the entire sample. And so this just shows 2D class averages as a just one of those steps where if you look, you have several classes that look very, very similar. So maybe we chose too many classes here. Of course, the recipe is that we better choose more classes than we need than fewer classes. But in the end, it would be much nicer if we also would be told how many classes are in a sample. Of course, that goes along with somehow defining what a class is and how different it must be from something else, so that we call it a different class. By the way, this is one of the panels from a system, the software that we're hoping to release very soon. I'm going to say a few more words shortly. Another challenge for a very heterogeneous data set is the ab initio 3D reconstruction. So there are now very nice new algorithms that do this. CryoSpark, Relion, and also a system can do this. But of course, the tests are usually done with well-behaved data sets that are either very homogeneous or maybe have a little bit of heterogeneity. So here, this just shows some of the tests that we've run on these three data sets and the time it took. So when you have something that is much more heterogeneous, that's not going to be nearly as easy. And in terms of a pipeline, as we've heard from Bridget, for example, you know, that you can get to a structure within a day or half a day. This is, if we really want to study things that are inside cells and so on and so forth, and maybe also things that are harder to purify biochemically, that's going to be harder to do because many of these steps will just become a lot harder. Computational resources. So you're going to hear more about how to make these programs run faster and what kind of computational hardware you need. I just wanted to quickly point out that we have this new software package called System that is imminently, very imminent from release. I don't want to give you a big introduction to the software. I just wanted to say that it runs quite fast. So this is it's timing for reprocessing the beta galactosidase data set that has now been used to benchmark different software packages. Or running this on a 44-core CPU machine, no GPUs, we can get this done to the final high-resolution structure in about 4.5 hours. And I wanted to draw your attention to the 2D classification step. So we didn't do 3D classification here. I know other tests did, so it's not a one-to-one comparison. But the 2D classification step here took about an hour. And one other feature of System is that it is quite flexible in how it runs on different hardware. So you can run it on a single workstation, but you can also run it on a computer cluster. And I think if we come back to this original idea of processing a huge data set, that is quite an advantage because that makes this extensive hardware of thousands of CPUs accessible to you. So it's much harder to find a GPU cluster of that size. So if we go back to 1.5 billion particles, n log n, assume about 1 hour for the 2D classification step, we had about 180,000 particles for this on on 44 CPUs. Then you can classify this in 5 hours on a 5,000 CPU core cluster. And of course, this ignores overhead that you will always have when you spread the load on many nodes. But this, the way we programmed this is such that the overhead is very, very small. So it's just to make the point that as these problems get bigger, the goal to have everything run on a local workstation may be delayed a little bit. I'm sure it's going to happen at some point, but as the problems get bigger, it is also useful to have access or be able to use larger systems. All right, so then in the last, I have 10 minutes, right? Yeah, last 10 minutes, I wanted to have a different view of this heterogeneous data set. And this is template matching. So far, we were concerned about determining new structures from such a heterogeneous mixture. But how about we already know these structures, we just want to find them. For example, to make quantitative, do a quantitative assessment of how many things are here or there, or whatever, or they are not in lysed cells, but you look at a tissue sample or a cell, sliced cell or whatever, and want to find molecules in there. So template matching, this is just from Baumeister's lab, is a well-established method in tomography, and it is usually reduced to a resolution that matches the visible features of the molecules that you want to detect. So something like 20 angstrom resolution. Okay, and this works in many cases where there's a distinct shape and where you don't have a very high density of protein, so that you can separate these things nicely. But of course, there are many cases where, for example, here, herpes virus entering a synaptosome, Kai Grunewald's lab, where you know it is much harder to find distinct shapes. But of course, the molecules are still in there. It's just you don't see them, you don't see the envelopes, the outlines. So this is a problem that Winfried Denk and a postdoc who we hired, Peter Rickauer, addressed. And so here's the idea. If you think of two different receptors here, NMDA and upper receptor, you know, rendered at low resolution, they may look like this. Of course, when they're all nicely separated, you can see which one is which. I mean, the AMPA receptor has much nicer ears than the NMDA receptor. When they're clumped together like this, it is much harder to tell what is where. But at higher resolution, you can find clear matches between these templates and this mix. Okay, and that's also going to be true when you add noise. So the idea is to do template matching with higher resolution. And of course, in tomography, in most cases, the tomogram will not, so high resolution, like 4 angstroms or so. And most tomograms do not contain a signal at that resolution. And therefore, the other idea is not to tilt and collect tomograms, but to just work with one single view where the resolution should match that what you also get with single particle preparations. Okay, so untilted and high-resolution template matching. And here are some tests. So with apoferritin, we know the atomic structure. We can calculate nice projections. And this is a cryo-EM image of apoferritin. We can see them very nicely here. At close to focus, you don't see them at all. So this is a gold particle. But you know, we know they are in there, of course, because this is actually the picture we took first, and then we took this. So the question is, can we find them using a template matching algorithm, or is this something that is too noisy, and we really need the low resolution information to see something? And so here's the result. This is I call a correlation map, but it's actually a sort of an average of many correlation maps, because there were you have to search with many different projections of this 3D structure. So this is a maximum intensity projection map, just showing, you know, for each pixel, if you think of a stack of different correlation maps for these different views, showing the maximum that was in the stack. So, and you know, you can see there are clear maxima in this correlation map. I highlight them for you here. That match the positions of apoferritin. So you can reliably detect this. You can also go in with another template, like Royale, for example. I'm not showing this, and will not get these matches. You will not see a peak. So this is very, very specific, and at least for apoferritin, it works very nicely. So what about a more crowded environment, like rotavirus, where we have we're trying to detect an asymmetric unit, so that's about 700 kilodaltons, and we're trying to find individual asymmetric units against the background of all other asymmetric units as well as the RNA genome. Okay, so it's quite a bit of background there. And so here's a close-to-focus image of three viruses. You can see in the correlation map where these viruses are because the variance of this map is higher in these regions. And when you zoom in, you see very nice peaks that correspond mostly with where we expect them based on the overall alignment of this particular virus particle. You know, so we know very precisely where they should be, and we can pick out these regions in the correlation map and then show where you know them together with the peaks that were actually detected. So it's about 75% of these asymmetric units were detected, and you can then you know plot them here in sort of a pseudo 3D way, and you can even match the defocus for the individual asymmetric units, and therefore place them in a three-dimensional reconstruction, if you want to. So these are this is not reconstructed from the images. This is reconstructed from the detected asymmetric units. So it looks, you know, looks reasonable. There are other, there are some places that are empty, and it's obviously interesting. Would be interesting to understand what exactly is going on there, why we can't see them. One possibility, of course, is there's something interesting going on about the, with the capsid, but it might also be just noise. Well, so that's something not clear at this moment. And then the final step is finding the RNA polymerase, a much smaller thing inside the capsid. So these polymerases reside on the fivefold axes, and there's space for only one of them. So it's five equivalent binding sites for the polymerase, but because of steric hindrance, once one binds, the other ones cannot be occupied anymore. So if you reconstruct such a, you know, a virus applying icosahedral symmetry, you end up with something that is fivefold averaged here, and therefore only shows you smeared out density of the polymerase that's bound there. So it looks a bit like this. So can we use this high resolution matching approach to find the binding, the bound polymerase for each vertex in you know, a whole data set of rotavirus particles. And so this is the template. And then this is the reconstruction. And I now realize this is something that we don't like. This can may well have template bias at this point. Previously, I just showed you detection. I did not reconstruct anything. This is an actual reconstruction based on the parameters that we determined with this template. Of course, this search did not search all possible angles and shifts. We only searched five positions for each vertex. So it was a much more restricted search, and therefore much more tolerant towards noise. Okay, so we you know, the 115 kilodaltons you would probably not find if you didn't know anything of where it was in the image. Okay, and so the reason this isn't entirely template matching, template bias, is that there's actually new density here that is not in the template. And so therefore, we think we actually found, in most cases, the polymerase. All right, and so we calculated about a 300 kilodalton limit of this template matching approach at the moment. But you know, images, this is based on current image quality. If images get a lot better, this would you know, predictions or simulations suggest would go down to something like 30 kilodaltons. And so it may potentially be a very nice approach to understand better, you know, cellular environments and so on and so forth, things that you typically study with cryotomography at the moment. And so we'll see what will happen. Okay, I think I'm running out of time, and I just want to acknowledge the people who I'm working with, Peter and Winfried, this template matching idea, and then system, Tim, in Alexei. Also want to acknowledge the Janelia Cryem facility that's doing a great job with the maintenance. Thanks.
Okay, why don't we have Steve set up, and Nico could perhaps answer a question or two in that time. Chris? Right at the back.
Hi, Nico. Sorry, can you see me?
No.
He's listening.
Yes.
Hi, Nico. Very interesting idea, this template matching. How do you calculate your reference projections to create this density map? Because that could make a big difference if they're not correct, right?
Right. We use one of these TM simulators. So trying to build in as much reality as possible. But I agree with you. This.
I have a question here. So back to the overlap particles. How do you define the overlap? Are they identical center and Euler angles? Do we have a cutoff? That's question number one. Question number two.
Let's stick with one. So,
okay.
So you're talking about the template matching.
No, idea. The overlapping particle. The
oh, the overlapping particles in the trip channel.
That's right.
That
50%.
Yes, they are. I mean, I have a particle stack. Overlap means this particle ends up in both cases in the final best class.
So have you tried to combine these to make a reconstruction instead of using the common particles? Because maybe none of these two are exactly correct or accurate enough by combining to make a map. And maybe
yeah,
this
would
is better.
Be even better than the individual ones. So as I said, that wasn't the primary purpose of this study, and therefore I have not really tried much else.